Okay, you have a classic structure, like, you know, what happens when Castro dies or something. This kind of structure, you know, or the, if the leader, and of course then when he got busted, and he wasn't there at all, the thing stopped. I think it's a real leadership program for parties, exactly like Dick Diver on the Riviera in what's the book called? Tender as the Night, that's right, isn't it? You know, where he tried to keep the sort of the family together, sort of by partying, and they were trying to get high. Do you remember that famous Christmas party scene? It's that kind of thing going on here. I think this is, I mean, I'm trying to talk about the area through which you get at what was happening there. I think that's the kind of thing. I think, you know, nothing more to be said about it except that, really, that it was, I think it was an extension of a great deal of that kind of desire for orgy.
I think,
you know, do you not think? What else to be said?
I don't know, because I've only read Tom Wolfe's book, and I only know what that says.
Yeah.
I don't believe that that's by
any. I think it contains a great deal of good things in it. Yeah, I think he's got the atmosphere very well.
It's not only Keyes's activities with the Merry Pranks, but the activities, the sort of mass initiation. It's like a John the Baptist sort of figure, and when he went to meet Timothy Leary, it was as if he was meeting the expert or something.
I think there's a lot of this. It's this guru business that you were talking about, Roger. This is leader bit.
According to Tom Wolfe, there's a continual disavowal on Keyes's part, which I can't take as spurious. Of this whole leadership situation.
I think, this is to do with the thing we talked about in connection with Paul Goodman and authority, didn't we? You know, in our course. That is, what is the nature of authority in these situations? The difference between coercive authority and what Paul Goodman calls natural authority, meaning the authority of expertise, creative ability, and so on. I think this is what was involved here, an experimental situation in which this was being worked out. And some people objected very much to Keyes because he appeared to him to be a coercive leader, authority, and some people didn't because they thought he was like, you know, a natural authority. And I think it was a very mixed situation in this particular way. I think Timothy Leary tries very hard to be a natural authority, in that Goodman sense, I'm using that word, idea. And is turned again and again into a coercive authority, meaning it's a messianic figure of some kind.
Keyes
suffered
from the same thing.
I think this is. I think one has to describe it like this, you know, continually. I think it's quite disastrous for many people to be in that kind of group, because it means that, you know, you do become a spectator of yourself after a while. Nothing happens. It's just like being at a football match. And
yeah, this is what I couldn't understand, how Keyes is at the centre of all this, and there seemed to be an abnegation of all sense of responsibility on his part.
For what?
For what he was doing, for the proselytising.
I think it may look like that, but I get the feeling that what was happening was that he did not want to stay, or should. He was like, we are doing this, and take it or leave it.
Yeah, but on the other hand, he spikes, he has 3,000 people at a meeting, and he spikes the punch with LSD. Everybody there has it whether they wish to or not.
I think that's unforgivable.
Well, so do I.
I think it's very silly, I think it's very dangerous. But it's the one thing I radically object to, but I think it was quite unique. And I'm not at all sure that Ken Keyes was responsible, actually. But I don't know. But everything one knows about Keyes, it doesn't seem to be anything like the sort of thing he would do. I just can't imagine him doing that. That's what it is. That seems to me a kind of silliness. You know, that the man that wrote One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest is not capable of, because he knows what lobotomization means.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's sort
That's
of
the sensation I had all the time.
Yeah. I mean, my alibi for Keyes, who I don't know at all, is that book. You know, the man that wrote that must know a thing or two about the nature of authority, because he was no big nerd. And that's a fact.
The insights don't necessarily last.
I know. I think the best part of that book, by the way, is the way he handled the angels, Hell's Angels. That just killed me. You know, he was like scared the daylights out of them because, you know.
If you compare it with Hunter Davies' account of it, the man who wrote the book on the Hell's Angels doesn't read the same way.
Is it Hunter Davies?
Hunter Thompson.
Hunter Thompson. Doesn't read quite
exactly the same. I thought it was very good. I must have, I'm inclined to believe the other one, I suppose. You know, they were really like, they were invited to meet the sort of creative area which they weren't prepared for.
Well, what I was trying to get you to say something about was the up in the ante situation. Now we encountered this in Paul Goodman. Well, what I can't understand is why, in conjunction with LSD, it should be necessary to have this up in the ante situation, given the sort of person, relying on what you know of Keezy from this other book, which is what I was doing, why he should be involved in a what seems to me to be a quest for sensation or a sort of 19th century.
I just don't know, because, you see, it's, as I say, like, come say it again, that the LSD-25 contains nothing except chemicals to change. And so one has to come back to the fact again. There's something already existing there, to see. And the whole setup of a community, with a utopian community within another community, as like a sort of anarchistic resistance centre, to see, which is raided and so on, is part of what we're talking about here, right? The Castalia thing. But people apparently need this kind of thing, and certain kinds of people. And then the ritual starts of certain kinds of clothing and incense burning and certain kinds of music. I must say, my withdrawal area from this completely is that Leary thought that the Sgt. Pepper record was really sort of way out to say this stuff. Okay, it was obviously an LSD record, in spite of what Paul McCartney said. I mean, that's a pack of lies, what he said in the Sunday Times, because anyway, it's as clear as daylight. It's just quite strict LSD stuff, but it seems to me to go to town on that, making it sort of like religious music and so on as they did at Castalia. It seems to me very curious indeed, and I don't understand that, but I may be wrong, but there was that tendency to be very with it and to in fact have a sort of a visible community of value, which is a counter community with a leader. And in those communities, there are some people with less courage than others. No, I'm not saying that in a snooty way. No, they just are. And therefore, they need a leader to represent them. Particularly in such a situation where you are so vulnerable because you're disobeying the law.
I think
this kind of situation evolved. You see what I'm trying to... I'm trying to like sort of say it, build it, rather than making like snap judgments on the thing. I think I'd be very careful. One's concerned with why do people want leaders and communities of this kind anyway?
I think one of the things that has to be taken into consideration on the American experience is this long tradition of instant enlightenment, instant religion, instant success, something which you can pay your money over the counter for and receive back in a package that's there, and the concomitant of that, which is instant disillusionment. And I think that a lot of these things that get taken up and dropped are the result of discovering that they only have one more method, which involves a lot of hard work, and that there are an awful lot of people who aren't prepared to accept any method that involves a lot of hard work.
Yeah, I think there's something in there. I don't know about the hard work part, but I certainly think the partying bit does involve very much the bit to do with getting pleasure very rapidly. People go to parties for that reason, don't they? I mean, to sort of to feel part of an orgy, even at a very small level, as quickly as possible, in order to get it now. But I really don't think, again, that has anything. I think that has to do with reasons why people get drunk as well as take LSD. So, you see what I mean? I don't think it has anything to do really. And I think, again, people take these drugs for reasons which have nothing whatever to do with changing of consciousness, you know, in order to learn in a beneficial way, but for reasons of despair. you know, I think this is it, of this terrible feeling that the whole society you belong to says you're supposed to be a certain kind of person and that you're supposed to be happy. I mean, the premium set on happiness in American society, and to a certain extent in ours, more or less so, that everybody is supposed to be enjoying themselves, basically, aren't they?
Yeah, you
see,
all the time.
You see, like, notices on people's desks in offices and signs on walls actually asking you to smile, which I reject.
Enthused.
I don't see why the hell, you know. And this kind of, and there's this terrible thing. I think this is where I would locate it, John. Like this, this awful. It's there in John, in Tom Paine, you know, that all those places where, right in those founding father documents, it says happiness. And there's, in a capitalist society, I don't so much in a totalitarian society of other kinds, but certainly there's this feeling that this is the reward. Because I'm told this is what it's for. It's for leisure, it's for happiness, it's for smiling, it's for whoopee, and like, and it's for this big, you know, what am I slaving my guts out for? And it doesn't occur. It just does not, because half the time you're worn out when you get home at six after your stint. And the next thing is it costs money, and worst of all, it really has to be trained. That spontaneous happiness in a city capitalist society isn't there. And I think that the idea of getting spontaneous happiness at the end of a tired day's work, if it isn't martinis or whatever, it's pot or LSD. Now, I'm trying to say this in terms of, like, you know, that I don't object to oblivion in a Puritan sense, but I think it's tragic. To my mind, really, I mean, I don't often use that word, you know, but it's to me tragic that so many people out of that condition need oblivious conditions. And then, of course, if they do take, I mean, you can get stoned out of your mind with pot, but LSD doesn't stone you, does not. And that's when they start saying, I had a bad trip. Because you don't get out of your mind, you're just hyper conscious, and that is painful.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
do you see what I'm saying? I mean, this is a psychedelic drugs are. We must say psychedelic drugs. In that way, we mean by that not alcohol and not all these things that obliviate you, but things which in fact open you up. Do you see? This is the point.
Yeah.
In that, like, mind. What did I say? Mind measuring, mind expanding thing. You see, this is. But I certainly think that the mistakenly people will go to it for, like, you know, instant oblivion or like kicks, as they say, which is like the Kant word, isn't it?
No.
But I think it's disastrous if you did it. I think it would be absolutely appalling because you just wouldn't get it for a start off. You know.
Yeah, drugs are as dangerous as literature. I'm sure.
That's exactly what Keating was doing, is propagating it under those terms, and that's why...
I don't think that's entirely true. I think he was very serious about this, because he was interested in the art side of it, and making things. You know.
Yes, but in his public activities, the more public activities, it was put forward under in precisely that...
I don't want to hold
it. It's always very difficult to tell what exactly has gone on in things that are publicized. Because
I just about
what
say
is
that
reported is always different from what happened.
Sure. I was just about to say, actually, I mean, the terribly obvious thing that Keating hasn't written it up himself.
No, well, I mean,
yeah, and this means that we're in a problem here.
And the other thing as well is that LSD is a form of disruption. I don't think you can take LSD and go to work the next day.
No, absolutely not.
Mm.
You just can't do it. Because, in fact, you do change. Don't you agree?
Yeah.
You just change. I mean, and it seems to me that one is involved here with something which is such that it realigns all those attitudes which are imprints in your protein structure. You know, we have to talk about it in terms of non-dualism completely in that way, because attitude is imprint in the protein structure of the RNA. And it means that if you do experience this realigning of those structures, and then you have to go back into the imprint area of your culture, you will resist it like hell. Unless, and there are a lot of unlesses, clearly, I mean, the kind of work you do, the kind of person you are, and so on. And clearly, Herman Kahn can go back to That's an institute with a tremendous amount of equanimity, isn't it? What?
I think he was on holiday from the revenue.
Yeah, was he?
I don't know.
I'd like to know.
I think
well,
when they were talking about putting acid in their flesh and everything,
mm,
it's just kind of, it's naive, but it's sort of wishful
thinking
that once people think that, they can't
mm
go back to the same
mm
way of life.
All right, this is not true. I mean, you might get just what you want, confirmation of your own shit. Mm. Right?
I
mean, this is a terrible thing. You might get sort of aligned such that all those things that the society is trying to imprint you with of value, you know, is reversed. This is a terrible problem with the thing. I've got to get into the chemical thing, but there's a problem here that it came out in an article in the Times recently. Did you see it? The fact that it turns out now that the original dogma that Crick and the other guy said, you know, that it's only a one-way thing. Of the imprint, the directions in the coded directions in the DNA, which are translated into the nucleic acids of the RNA, which means how those particular genes come out in this particular character, can in fact, in virus situations, that is, in infected situations, be reversed. So that the charge inside the RNA, affected by a bad chemical structure somehow, is imprinted back into the DNA and then starts affecting it. And then, of course, you get congenital diseases, those kinds of things. Okay. And that might be a psychic thing, it strikes me, you know, that you would in fact reverse the situation such that you'd be worse than you are because you'd refuse the new imprinting. This seems to be quite possibly on the cards, and that would explain a great deal.
That would make you very psychotic.
I think it really would. I think Herman Kahn is. Don't you think? I mean, don't you think? I mean, I think that the definition of psychosis would have to include the man who can, with tremendous equanimity, write endless books on total earth destruction and then come on and saying, I didn't mean it. You know, or, you know, similar moral gestures. Like, what?
Be happy.
Be happy, yeah. There's a marvellous work by Luigi Nono that's out on a record now, which includes the texts are statements by Che Guevara and various people in North Vietnam, and a statement by a Detroit resistant car worker, and so on, that kind of material. And then at the end, there are Herman Kahn's, I think it's 42 methods of waging war in the modern world. Remember that? I think it's in the scenarios. Which he like fused in into this awful structure, and that one feels, you know, that maybe he elucidated himself so far that he could think up 42 ways of making war. God, one wasn't enough, I must say.
A sort of aggressive Kama Sutra.
John. I feel really that now I do think that one of the ways, which is a shortcut thing, I'm for it in a sense, I really am. I think one must be very non-puritanical. I mean, you know, Buckminster Fuller's right about this, that we have built into, I have built into me, a lot of training which says hard work, right, coming back to the thing you said, is the only way to get it when you want it, you know, like, I was impregnated in me, like, I never get my university scholarship, I work hard, you know, and all this kind of thing, like, work hard, right? Ever since you start, I'm sure you know this one, it's a sort of, you know, little area which you're like, come from, this, you know, like, you know, we haven't got any money, so you better work for your scholarship, I never get to go to college. And one lives in a state of sort of semi-petrification. Well, you know, all these poor kids who half die when they don't get the 11 plus, or before they get the 11 plus, you know. And they do half die, because Chris Eddy's daughter, a friend of mine, I don't even know who he is, had a terrible time. I just wrecked it. It was just awful. And she didn't even set the exam, you know. She was like paralytic, this poor kid. It's wickedness. Okay, anything to get through that is what I want to say. And it seems to me that molecular biology might really obviate a great deal of sheer wicked torture called education. Just that. The cut right through the whole bit that somehow accumulation, weight, time, energy expenditure over a long period, call all that called work, may be the most immoral thing we have on our hands. Just that. Burden people with all that. And okay, if it's possible to manufacture techniques whereby you stop being stupid very quickly, you gain non-verbal experience. I mean, you know, there are now they're talking about eating your education. That you can swallow something which is in fact changing your DNA structure, such as you have Russian. Or you can inject babies in the womb with German, Russian, Arabic, French. So they don't have to bother with all that shit like learning it, you know. I'm not sure how I feel about that. But it certainly is on the cards. This is going to happen. Because once it is understood that everything you have inside you is a measurable product, it means that you can put it in and take it out. After all, they've already manufactured an artificial gene. University of Wisconsin, last year.
No, I don't like the
so like
who might be in control of what one got in.
Well, there's the CIA guy I mentioned, who was at the University of Michigan Medical School, where they were doing this transplanting parts of frogs' bodies into sterile cells.
Maybe this guy you were quoting really couldn't remember. Maybe he'd been injected.
He smiled as he said it. Yeah, right. Maybe that was injected too. Yeah, that's just a little Aristotelian regression going on. I mean, once one reads science fiction and one isn't alone, it's just awful, isn't it? I mean, one feels that, how do you know you're not an android? Might be the next, instead of writing like, does consciousness exist? In 1909, in 1970, you write, how do you know you're not a cyborg?
The mind is in a continual state of bogglement.
Yeah. But I don't feel, I think very seriously though, that it seems to me that education now must include this. And I know what the risks are, of course, but it seems to me that the infernal stress on verbal and numerical accumulation and the amount of a child's life between the age of what, 5, sometimes earlier, to the age of whatever,
80,
that goes into this, like everything is translated into numeracy and literacy when you know that the body is neither numerate nor literate, and that's what you've got. There must, I strike me something terribly wrong about this. I'm trying to cut across your hard work syndrome here, like, you know. I think you've got to drop that, John, dear friend.
Oh, nonsense. You work harder than anybody I know.
But I don't feel it, you see, as work at all. I feel it as a kind of a terribly pleasurable necessity to me. You know? I mean, something.
Well, it's all a question of semantics.
And the terrible thing is that I don't know how you felt. We're on some tricky ground here, Roger. That something that happened to me was that I now feel accentuated something which was there inside me, which was really open to my inspection under these experiences. And that is that I really have a sort of cross between a yawn and a laugh confronted with experience now. Do you know? I mean, that's a terrible feeling that none of it really matters at all. That it is some extraordinary joke, you know, like I experienced this without the LSD, this sense of what the Buddhists call the void, you know, that like everything you do just like vanishes inside the whole mass of energy, which means that one is for me it means a fantastic sense of relaxation. I really don't care, you know, that sort of. In that kind of area, finally. So that it's not work. It's terribly difficult to put this without sounding completely irresponsible. I don't mean that. I just mean that in certain areas of belief and thinking, good and bad and irresponsibility and responsibility is an irrelevant way of talking about it, that's all. You know? It just happens. It is. And I know what that means now very well. And it was there inside me a great deal of it, and I just know it. Fortunately, it comes out with not going without going berserk, or like, you know, going and standing on a pole. Like, that Simonides, you know, whatever.
Yeah, well, I think there's a sort of relation to that. Like, Burroughs talked about these opium smokers, you know, just sitting in their room and talking about everybody else out there, you know.
I think that's very much to do with though, the fact that they are Buddhists already.
Yeah, but I think there's people, you know, who just drop trips and then just sit and listen to it for hours on it.
And I can understand that.
There's all sorts of things going on there, which, you know, I mean, they're all standing there laughing. You know, it's not a normal response.
Right.
They're just fascinated. They can't get away from it.
I think it's true. I think that it's...
One's toe will do.
What?
I say one's toe will do for a examination.
Yeah. Well, why not, you know, as they say.
Or classically, one's navel.
Yeah, I think that's the kind of walk. You have to bend down. It's not those Buddhist statues where, you know, they've got such a fat tummy and they just stick up like this and they just sort of lean back a bit.
Yeah, you have to eat a lot.
You have to be a real fat Buddha to sort of really get going on your name, I reckon.
Yeah.
If you do, if you're fat enough and you make the lotus position, your stomach does sort of pop out and a little thing appears.
If he'd been thin, I wonder what he would have contemplated.
I go facetious. You're facetious, John. You have a streak of irresponsibility in you. I don't know what we're telling you this about. Yeah. I think that, no, to answer that thing about this hard work thing, I think it depends, you know. Do you feel it in terms of dreadful, burdensome accumulation
I didn't really. What I meant was just intensive, continuous concentration.
Yeah.
You know, not something dreadful.
But it isn't. It isn't feeling of concentration unless you feel it's kind of feeling concentration. You see what I mean? If it in fact it takes place, just
well,
like that.
Call it anything you like that doesn't involve all these negative connotations that we're talking about.
This, again, coming back to this education thing, I think if people were taught conditions of discovery of information, which was not work, but you were in a receptive condition and a transmittory condition. The idea of schoolwork being objectionable, you know, and all this, all the learning process being objectionable, would be completely transformed.
Well, there's a gesture in this direction in America with you know, TV children's programming like Sesame Street.
Yes, right. Yes,
that.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Which
you better explain
the process of learning through television commercials, sort of.
There's a whole Summerhill thing, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Enjoyable and right. Instead of imposing it from without, making the child
right.
Produce something.
I think this is got to be looked into. Fantastic amount, much more than we do. Much, much more. Because there's not a lot of terror in education.
Yeah.
I mean, real terrorist tactics called learning processes. Like forcible feeding, isn't it? And it's so terrifying. And you know why the kids don't like it.
Sure.
I didn't. I was very rebellious. I mean, boy, you know, not because I wanted to be stupid. The extreme opposite. I think I was probably very precocious in many ways, but I had a terrible reputation at school, being naughty and all that, you know, and being beaten. And I remember feeling I didn't understand it, because, you know, this sounds like terrible, come on, thing, but I used to get all these school prizes, and, like, you know, I was good at all that, but I could never understand, you know, this other side of it. I was very rebellious somehow about things. I think a lot of kids are like that.
Yeah.
You know, there's all this tension between, you want this stuff, it's interesting for crying out loud.
Mm.
But the conditions make you rebel against the way you're having to absorb it, huh?
Yeah.
Don't you think this is
Sorry,
true?
Very often it is the most intelligent children, the ones who are ahead of what is going on, ahead of the game, who are the ones who do rebel.
I think it's true. And I think that it's to do with the fact that you resent very much the process rather than the information, don't you think?
That marvellous Orwell essay, you know, such were the joys that we were talking about before.
Yeah. And also the authority. I mean, it does come back to the Burroughs thing. The whole thing does obviate, and I know you probably disagree a bit on this, but no, I'm not saying it, but I mean, there's this other context of leadership thing. But one of the things that the molecular biology area does obviate is authoritarian programming. You know, if in fact you can do it, become conscious, get your information without that teacher-class situation, you know, or without the sort of leader situation, or without a sort of some kind of policing thing through which the information is imparted to you. You know, because like the examination system is like the law, isn't it, really, inside a school. You know, it's like the ultimate retributive thing that the policeman can bang on you, right? You see what I mean? In that way, it's a legal structure, education. So that one wants to say that, in fact, that one of the things that could go on in this particular, with these new, these other ideas would obviate that once and for all, would it not? All those ways in which kids grow up thinking that anything of value is expensive in those terms of expenditure of energy, which has nothing to do with information, but it's to do with obedience. You know, and the idea that you obey information is ludicrous. Mm-hmm. What you're really obeying is a teacher that's handing it to you. Huh? Do you see what I'm saying? And insofar as Ken Kesey, if he was in fact like that, I would object to it intensely. And insofar as Tim Leary is like that, I would object to that too. And one of the great things about Gary Snyder, it's very clear to me from everything one hears about, is that he had found the way, of all people, to do it properly. You know, to be someone who knew and could be a natural authority. Do you see what I'm trying to say?
One of the most completely unauthoritarian
right.
people I've ever met.
I think Allen Ginsberg too, to me. But then I like worship him not a messianic sense, but I mean he shows me things that I want to know continually. And he doesn't do it with any sort of sense of fake modesty. You know, he just is an anti-leader. It's as easy as that. And I think Snyder's like, I think it's possible, you know, to build situations which are good ones. And I got to feel I'm more with you than I thought on the Mary Prankster thing. You know, I think there's too much direction in that particular way.
Unfortunately, almost everything can be twisted to authoritarian purposes and uses. I mean, one can even imagine LSD trips under authoritarian direction.
All right.
Carry people in desired, quote-unquote, direction.
I think the whole molecular biology thing can, in fact, be that way. But I find, with all respect to you, John, I'm not sure about the LSD thing. I get a feeling that the way it works would be very, very difficult to control from outside, didn't you think?
I'm sure it's difficult.
I find
I'm sure somebody's working on it.
What?
I'm sure it's difficult, but I'm sure somebody is working on it.
You see, what all you can do about this, I mean, all those you're right about this, what you're going to say, I think, that the under these therapeutic ways in which they're handled. I mean, what is the control situation? The control situation is the dosage. Now, we don't know what the ultimate dosage would be because there isn't one, and it's not lethal, but we do know that you can scale off certain effects from experience, that so many grams does that, do you see? It's very, very rough. But, and very speculative and experimental indeed. But the psychiatrists are using this kind of thing, and by the way, they are of no particular psychiatric school, which is immediately non-authoritarian. Seem to me to be to using minimal controls to develop maximal changes, which release these people who are in a bad, you know, really. I mean, they are rigid. They usually use LSD on people who are in conditions of inflexibility, of rigid. What is it? Burroughs' great phrase for this: inexorable something.
Oh, immovable and
irresistible. This is. Use words like yes, right. And what is that? Is it inexorable authority or some such phrase you use like that? Well, you know the kind of phrases I mean. And it's that kind of person that benefits from it.
Entropic, in fact.
Right, because they're so, like, over-systematized that their bodies are communicating inside continually in a rigid condition. As if somehow the synapses need relaxing.
Yeah.
Now, LSD can do that. Don't you think this is something?
They did a program on it, about how they were using it before it all came up.
Yeah.
And they show the psychiatrist the film, and then they were touching each other during the process, and they had a British actor who came on after, appalling, they should actually touch the
right. Right. Yeah.
Anglo-Saxon practice.
Yeah. Well, Reich's onto that one too, isn't it? I mean, this vegetotherapy thing with Reich. I don't know whether any Reich. One thing I don't know if any Reichians used LSD. I don't think it would be necessary. Which like comes back to the. I get the feeling there's all sorts of techniques that obviate the use of these things if you're new. But by Reichian vegetotherapic methods, you know, to do with muscular control, bodily positions, you know, massage, and like manipulating organs in the body by pressing on them, you know, and things of this kind, can in fact change the rigidities in the structure. That's if the rigidities change, that changes the whole psychosomatic structure completely, and that's where Reich scores, because it's nothing to do with verbal techniques at all. Do not think. I mean, it would be very surprising if any Reichian had to use LSD indeed, in fact, because you might be able to do it from this other angle. Huh?
Do you think included in that are educative processes? I think that there could be creative forms of
what in the Reichian thing?
Yes, a combination of these techniques which can be used in schools apart from any.
I think so. I mean, it's easy to say just like that, but golly, I think I'm inclined to say we better. I really do. The more I hear about what goes on in schools, the more it scares the daylights out of me. And you know, I go around these days. I mean, I think I said this before, it's going to be boring, but I mean, I went down to that school in South London, Emmanuel School, the grammar school. And all those sixth form boys in their blazers, and well, sitting there rigid, and you know, it was just gruesome. And then, of course, about two thirds of the way through the thing, they're also lying around, their ties are undone, and one feels that, you know, half the time that they've got into terrible bad habits of what is the accurate receptive pose, the bodily position, you know, and they've been trained that this is it, and it's called respectable or something. Do you know what I mean? And half the time, that the information, as I say, is an obedience program rather than learning. Then they wonder why they fail the exams, because all they've learned is appropriateness rather than information. Do you know what I mean? That's what terrible thing. And I think anything we can stop that. I think we're in a terrible state about it.
It's like 15 years earlier than that.
I'm with you on that, but I'm just saying that's what the end product is, and why I'm just like justifying why I think that it. I may sound kind of like, you know, blatant about it and saying it just like offhand, but I know really exactly how I feel when I do.
I really
these
feel
damn
sorry
things
for these poor kids that now go through an elementary education, which is increasingly permissive and non-directive in this country, and very much ahead of most of the rest of the world, and then are dumped straight into to junior school.
But is that any worse, really, John, than being trained to be rigid and inflexible?
Probably not.
And then being dumped into the world, where you're encouraged to be like that still, all along. And as you're, oh, he's gone, but Phil Gordon's essay was saying, you know, like all these people who live double lives. I mean, Phil was saying in his thing about the schizophrenia thing, to do with the fact that most people live schizophrenic lives. You know, they have one standard for the office, one standard for home, one standard in bed. You know, I mean, they use their wives as kind of holes. And at the same time, they sort of say, we respect people's lives, you know. And then they come on, like, pray in church. And then but that the devil isn't involved when a bit of shady business is in hand, if it means more money, and so on and so on. I mean, millions of people live completely schizophrenic structures all the time. And they rigidify themselves so that they can do it. And they're trained to do that. You know, there is no criminal class, as the man says. I think that it's possible to envisage at least ways in which this can be much, much easier, much quicker changed, then the 19th century inheritance suggests to us that you have to go through long processes of personal transformation, and that you have to work at it, and that you have to that somehow it's a self-sacrificial program, you know, somehow that you've got to live a life of sacrifice, and you know what I mean, this sort of scarcity economy bit. And then finally, if you're lucky, you'll make it, you know. And then the next thing, you're supposed to pass this one on to your children. You know, they've got to be self-sacrificing, and you know, and on and on. And that whole 19th century programming of somehow obedience, self-sacrifice, sacrificing other people, like, you know, to yourself. And that sort of model of life. The idea that somehow we have to do it over a long period can probably be obviated by all sorts of therapeutic methods. The methods are now used therapeutically, but could be obviated by using them as part of educational processes. So we just live better. Why not? There's no problems about it, by Langston.
There are even just straightforward teaching methods of doing things much more efficiently and more quickly than are done.
Yeah, I think it's true.
The speed with which languages are learned at Monterey Language School and the U.S. Army, for instance,
yeah.
In about 6 months they come out learning more than they ever learn in years and years of high school and college study.
But while schools are, in fact, very much in their classroom structures and their student staff bit and so on, very much to do with obedience programming, I think it seems to me that any kind of so-called up-to-date method of teaching just plays back into it, you know, continuously, doesn't it? You know, it's just awful. I believe very strongly in teaching machines, because it at least obviates some of the authoritarian business of having the thing beaten into you. At least you're left alone with a machine that can't, like, bash you over the edge. So, I mean, this seems to me as a gain.
Yeah.
If you are really are learning French.
That's not true, because the machines operate a hierarchic structure of Marx and Engels, which do beat you over the head.
But if you turn back, you do get penalized.
Yes.
Yes, but the fact is, you haven't got this man who's going to hit you, is what I said.
Yes,
but
it's far more insidious, because you're far more insidious, because you're punished against the percentage.
Yeah.
It's much worse.
Yeah. But don't you think it's impersonal? Do you really think that?
I think that makes all the worse.
You think so? Yeah. I'm not sure about that. I've always thought that the but you don't feel personally punished when you die. Roger, you're not going to tell me. Mind you, I think the Japanese do on those damn pachinko things. When I was in Tokyo, I saw they have these pachinko arcades. And it's very clear that Japanese psychology, which is a kind of sadomasochistic psychology, a national cultural psychology, is very much to do with, it cuts right across the classes, because the people playing these pachinko games are of no particular class, you know, you see people, wealthy businessmen, and it's really very much to do with this, you know, punishment programs of not winning. And maybe I'm wrong about that, but it's just that it just seems to me to be possible to say, at least, that to be relieved of the authoritarian situation of the classroom.
I don't see that at all, because it operates the same reward structure that the teacher does.
Do all teaching machines do that?
Well, the ones the advanced ones, I think, do.
Do they?
Not the simple.
Are there any teaching machines that don't sort of like have reward punishment things? But are there? God, I'm ignorant. I didn't know that. Well, I take back what I'm saying completely. In that case, I didn't realise that.
There are, for instance, some teaching machines that have been developed for very young children, which are just playthings which disclose certain kinds of information according to what's fed into it by the child, and which are just things to play with. Very elaborate.
I think the complex spelling machines that they've evolved are not authoritarian. The ones in which you've got a, which are a a typewriter which operates on a screen as well and rejects misspellings and stuff.
Yeah,
I think that's
yeah,
one thing.
Yeah.
But the informational ones, the ones which deal with geography or something like that, give you a score as far as I can see.
And,
yeah.
And there's that one
the
which...
Do children feel oppressed by this?
I don't know, no idea.
Do you know?
I don't know, they've got a unit at the college I've gone to, so I'm
going to... I'd be most interested to see what you find out about that, wouldn't you? Because it seems to be very important.
I've looked at them, seen how they work.
It must. One says like sort of automatically, but one says it must be possible to build information inside children such that there isn't punishment and obedience structures, isn't it?
Got it. Math ones, you know, put your answer down and turn it on. If it was wrong, you went back, you know.
Yes.
According to you, got it wrong.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that that
that's not so bad.
Oh no, but you know, it's all marked in later.
Oh yes, I mean
since
that. No, I was purely and simply interested in reducing the authority position of the master or mistress or whatever in the charge of the class.
Well, that's so arbitrary anyway. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, the sheep.
Don't you think there's something in it? No, clearly you don't.
I'm sorry, to take exception to that, because that's exactly what I was trying to move Eric onto. The fact that it's not a reward, it's not a punishment situation anymore. It's become more enlightened that it's a reward of love, and if you do the right thing, you get stroked, sort of thing.
By what?
By the machine.
I mean, there's a whole thing come out.
Yeah.
No, but you get...
I'm trying to be facetious, but I mean...
I know you.
That'd be marvellous if somehow, like, you had a sort of, like...
A
tremor. through your body. No, Peter, I thought we were being facetious. But it would have been rather exciting, wouldn't it? Like, you got the sums right, and you had, like, a blue flash, like...
Well,
an odic force like comes through. Yeah. No, sorry. What you were saying?
Well, I think it's because it's set in the structure of linear progression, and that when you completed one assignment, you're permitted to go on to another.
Yeah.
And it's the same as the teacher having said, the teacher pretending a concern and a subjectivity in the situation and saying, you've been a good student, I approve of you.
Yeah.
I don't, it doesn't worry, I agree that it's all directed towards processing.
You don't think that what you were saying, like, you know, that it was important to have some kind of reward of love.
Well, that's what I take.
And you don't like the idea of reward at all?
Not at all, no. Certainly not, because I think that's a more insidious form of brainwashing than submission.
I must say, too, I think provided it's a mutual thing here, because I think what one would have to say is that
not because it's entirely spurious.
One of these sort of things. I mean, if in fact you know nobody ever says anything to you,
it can be a bit trapping. I think if your rewards never come, you always get it wrong. That's when you need it.
Yeah.
But
it works the other way, doesn't it? I mean, the fact is that the human gets in the way.
Oh yeah.
Because the human being there is like determined to be in the way,
yeah,
and doesn't want to leave you like with the thing, huh? So that it's yours finally.
And
I think
you and the machine, you and other people.
Yeah.
But as long as you're doing it for the reward or to avoid the punishment, you're not doing it for the thing itself. Should have been getting at before.
Exactly.
It's far important. Does he want to do it for its own sake?
Even the you would include the reward of a pat on the back and laugh.
Yeah, I think it's rather nice, but it's not really an education all about. Should be, you know.
I think this is what I'm saying. I'm pretty tricky ground here, but if it is possible, one wants to say, to receive and as a receptor information which you need, and which is going to make your life happier and more pleasurable and more exciting. Without that kind of reward and punishment, pleasure, pain, environment situation, I think we'd better look into it. And if one of the ways is through molecular biology, there seems to be a very good case of saying it is necessarily then a better structure. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, that kind of, anyway, like one throws that out and says, like, you know, well, what about that? Isn't that, doesn't that sound right?
Yeah.
But I mean, it's terribly difficult for me to, I mean, as soon as one says things like that, when the whole one plays backlog as a schoolboy comes in,
yeah,
and thinks, oh, how are you aged it? Like,
right.
And half the time, I'm probably really saying, you know, I don't want any kid to have to go through all that.
Sure, but on the other hand, it's dangerously near becoming authoritarian itself, isn't it?
So yeah.
When we're going to start tinkering about with...
It's the situation that counts, isn't it? Don't you? I mean, and what one's got to say is that what one has to create is the situation of transmission and reception,
mm-hmm,
of the information which is like one hopes required. That is an authoritarian idea, but I think one can say that a certain amount is required without, mm-hmm, like being too pig-headed about it. And that if in fact the atmosphere is one of continual exchange in a particular,
mm-hmm,
way, I think it can be done without a sort of even a love situation. You see what I mean? If we can get the situation such that there's a mutuality, you know, of concern,
mm-hmm,
it might obviate too much of it. I'm not saying entirely, but like a weight of this need. Because if you need someone to love you that much, you're in a position of subservience, aren't you? Do you see what I'm trying to say? And that is a dangerous... Don't you agree?
You are throwing the kids to one, aren't you?
Yeah, and this is I remember it, don't you? I remember it as a boy, longing for somebody, you know, like to say I did it properly.
Yeah.
And like, you know, feeling pretty good when they said it.
The majority of,
and it's nothing whatever to do with information, it's to do with like feeling like you belong.
Well, education is obviously there's information at school. There's a series of steps,
sure,
which you're going to take.
Yeah.
But it's very difficult to say where.
I think you can have a human situation. I'm trying to come back to what you said, because it's very important. I think you can have a human situation without the love reward thing in it, in effect. Do you know? I think you would have a situation of mutual need,
well,
such that
you have to. I mean, that's basic proposition, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, right, well, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
The other is a spurious control system, which is
right,
just more insidious than
the
present...
No, I was just like, can't say too much, I think. Yeah.
Well, I'm saying, yeah, certainly the love thing is a very necessary thing, but how far is this a necessary part of human relationships, and how far a necessary part of teaching? Because
and if it's that necessary, it does get into the old power structure again, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
If you need someone to love you that much...
Mm-hmm.
Or vice versa, you need to love somebody that much,
mm-hmm,
that it becomes a pleasure-pain situation.
Mm-hmm.
This is like a dominance submission structure,
sure,
isn't it? And it's
in a way just getting in the way of the education itself.
Yeah.
I mean, one can have sort of good relationships
is,
with
yeah,
teachers and this sort of thing. This is fine.
It's quite irrelevant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not exactly what you know.
No, I agree with it. I find as a teacher it's a very difficult thing to work. I mean, I'm not pretending this is easy.
Mm-hmm.
I find it very difficult indeed to find ways, like just structurally, you know,
mm-hmm,
of doing this thing. I think it has to be done. I still believe very much in this, but I must say, coming back to where it all started, I still think that I've learned only just recently that there are other techniques, I'm quite certain now, to do with what one calls consciousness and receptivity and perception, which I was never taught at school. And I'm certain if I had known about it, would have been of great use to me.
Yeah.
You know? Of techniques of... After all, one can say about LSD, it is a form of information. You know, one can say about yoga and mantra and all this kind of... It is a form... I mean, by that, it's like a restructuring of energy. Do you see what I mean? A metamorphosis of energy. That's...
It's weird as well, because, you know, the way they say that pot smoke,
yeah,
pot smoke is the road, very receptive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also, I think that the this community thing is comes in here, because one of the things that Gary Snyder points out, and Tim Leary, is that we mustn't think, oh, he's gone, but the we're involved in here, that if people do live together, I think I quoted this when I was doing my notes, that the if people do live together and spend more time with each other than at work and looking at TV,
mm-hmm,
they will move into a situation which obviates overwhelming love situation, because they are with each other. You know, like, and the touch thing is involved as well, isn't it? You know, that if there is a continuous proximity and a continuous wrapping and a continuous you know, like community thing. A lot of this stuff that one gets worried about is obviated automatically, you know. And if in fact the LSD and the pot helps that, I think one must be for it. You know, with no question to my mind. And then you've got a, then you have this situation where it isn't overwhelming love and need for it that's involved, because you've got the community of touch.
That's up already,
yeah. And this touch thing is tremendous. This is where Reich scores, because he knows very well that, you know, that a bodily contact, just like skin to skin, with a minimal minimal overt eroticism, is like a non-verbal transaction,
yeah,
of the most potent kind.
Yeah.
Like that kind of thing. I think this is something we've got to be concerned with deeply. And when you were saying, like, you know, these guys were touching each other and so on, one knows very well under those conditions that half the time psychotherapy operates just there. You know, you see the work what they do with them back with children. And half the problem is to get the children to tolerate that touch thing.
Mm-hmm.
You would do it with dogs. You know how, like, some dogs like cringe because they've not had it. Right. Well, when a friend of mine went down to the East End, I think I told you about Chris Eddy, when he went, a student of mine, and he went down to a terrible tough school in the East End and was given, like, the bachelor section, as he wanted this. And these, like, brutal kids, they really were very brutal, age about 12 to 14, kicked him and spat at him and hit him and barged up against him. And very slowly, so all, I won't go into the story because it's a long story, very slowly, with more patience than I've got, for a start, let alone him, he slowly got to the point where they understood what they were doing. They wanted to touch him. It was absolutely obvious to him that what they wanted to do was that. And slowly they did. Slowly those boys, they learned one thing. They didn't learn anything else. They learned basic information. That is, that if you want to, Chris was saying, if you want to touch me, touch me. Like, and he won. He won completely. Just on that basis. Very slowly. Under a great deal of suffering, I must say. But he did it. And I always said to him, like, well, you've done nothing else in your life, Chris. You did that. Like, you know, that is a triumph, right? Fantastic achievement. But oh boy, he suffered. He really suffered. And his wife, of course, because she got the brunt of it at home when he got home. But this is like, you know, this is what I would call information, educational information, processing, that kind of thing. But it's, God, it's so basic for so many people, and particularly for the kids in school. It's terrifying. Because, like, they're brought up in obedience. I read a book of poems written by some East End kids in the Montessori school down in East End, a friend of mine gave me. And you can see it there. Most of the poems are about that kind of range of areas, like of the need, of needs, you know, that they want.
There's an awful lot of withdrawn children.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of an awful lot of the school where I was.
Mm.
And I think if you're teaching children, you're just going to
identify. Yeah. Right, yeah. I think it's true. I think it's absolutely true. But I don't think the teaching machine should be done in a vacuum, of course. You know, one needs the situation. No, it is the situation one requires. I wouldn't put too much strength on this. But certainly the this business of the dear old Walt Whitman and, like, Allen Ginsberg and a lot of other people involved in, like, you know, this skin proximity thing is without, you know, what most people in this country are brought up to think of, and that is kind of violation of yourself.
Yeah, but if you just see it on sort of tube trains or buses,
yeah, right,
people are taking great care to stay far away.
Right. I'm in my own life, I don't know how you, but in my personal life, I found that's a problem for me. It's a thing I've got through now to a certain extent. But I remember, like, you know, recognizing a certain point, and very much through reading Ginsberg and Whitman, you know, or like, and knowing Alan, that there's nothing to be frightened of. But I found that I had all sorts of things built into me through the kind of structure I was led into, that I just was not making any kind of contact with anybody, you know, except verbally, for God's sake. Sounds useless. Well, not useless, but like part
of it. There's more than one kind of physical contact as well, and in a crowded tube or a subway or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
I resent
the person that...
yeah, that's going to be interesting, darling. You mean like being goosed?
No, I resent the person that walks straight into me as if I weren't there.
Oh, well,
and
yes.
And makes no
acknowledgement
of it.
Yeah, that's
and
I agree.
And the sort of jostling of people who, use their elbows and so forth, which is very different from simply being in close proximity to somebody, standing up in a crowded tube or something like that.
But it's very funny because during that tube strike, when there were very few tube trains, I remember going home, everybody wedged in like sausages or something like that, the elbows. And first of all, everybody was like very tense staff or sort of like there and something. And very slowly, the whole thing relaxed by about three stations or four stations on. And people were getting slightly hysterical about it, which was kind of, it was kind of nice. They really got relaxed.
Yeah.
They were kind of like getting giggly. And there wasn't an awful lot of talk, but there was obviously a great deal of enjoyment going on.
Yeah.
It seemed to be very clear that everybody was all like rammed together. And there was a complete sort of unmistakable atmosphere of relaxation, which is weird.
Yeah.
It was bloody hot and it was aggravating and so on. Even through that it occurred, you know. It was very hot.
I was in one of those and there was some guy standing close to me who was sort of pressed in against a couple of females. And
well, that's kind of luck.
He turned his head over his shoulder to me and said, I'll be lucky if I get out of this without a fraternity suit.
Yeah, oh well. It's always the girls. I think the girls enjoy the men's proximity too. They never say it. Yeah, right.
On who is proximate.
Yeah, the degree.
The thing I found was that if you wanted to get past somebody and you just walked into them, that's very bad. But if you put your hand on their shoulder before you walk, they'd already got a sort of message from that.
Yeah, I think this is true. I think there's a great deal to be thought about with these things. And certainly, this, what I was getting at was this community thing. I think it's a very important matter. We were talking about this when you visited this thing to do with the, if in fact the community is there, of living with each other much more than Americans do normally, more than us. I mean, I think that it's difficult enough in this country, and in the cities, to do with distances apart at work, and then the television distances, a lot of these communities thrive on just that sheer amount of being with each other, talking to each other, touching each other, proximity, and that creates the situation in which overwhelming needs of love are obviated, so you don't get into the subservient position, but you just take it gently, And then using the LSD then or pod would have a beneficial thing. It wouldn't set up leaders. You see what I'm saying? I'm just thinking about what you were saying earlier. That it is a different kind. So that the community itself is an important thing.
There are
communities like that. In fact, there are the communes of this kind.
The response in America to the Esalen Institute is certainly indicative of need.
I'm going to, if you don't mind, ladies and gentlemen, I just have